The lesson is taken from the Gospel according to St. John, chapter 15, verses 12 to 17. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love hath no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you, so that you will love one another. This is the word of the Lord.
May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Well, good morning. Warm welcome to St. John's on this Remembrance Sunday. You're all very welcome. I hope, as I said earlier, that many of you will be able to join us across the road at the splendid new war memorial that we have now, because we'll be remembering with our 2 minutes silence at 11 o'clock at that time. You should be aware, perhaps some of you don't know this, but that war memorial is quite rare. By rare, I mean that it is only one of six war memorials in the country of an actual service person. And the statue is of a young man called Haron Baronian. He was a private in the British Army, and he was killed in Mesopotamia on the 11th of April, 1919. He had just turned 21. And he came under heavy rifle fire trying to hold a ridge. His name is on the Basra Memorial in Iraq. His father came from Armenia but moved to England to work in the cotton trade in Manchester. And he set up a successful business importing Chinese cloth. And they lived on Lee Road. A friend of Haron's wrote about him, "He was always cheerful under conditions of life so different from his comfortable Knutsford home. He was eagerly looking forward to the front somewhere. He wrote several times to me from Mesopotamia, always full of service and duty." And so we're here today then, I guess, to remember Haron Baronian, but not just him. We're here to remember all those who have died in war, especially those who've died for us. We who now live in the United Kingdom. And so today, above all days, is when we all come together to remember. Remember is the opposite of dismember. So when we remember, we pull our history together, and we are mindful of our long history. The history of men and women who suffered and died to make this country a better one. And so we cast our minds back to the wars that we've gone through, to Afghanistan, Second World War, First World War. And you can push all the fighting and all the wars back into the mists of time. It just goes on forever. And it's important that we stop to remember, because as I've said before on occasions like this, to remember is what makes us human. The Bible tells us that God has set eternity in our hearts. And because eternity is in our hearts, we're mindful of the passing of moments. The writer of the book of Ecclesiastes that the mayor read from, Ecclesiastes chapter 3, says we're aware of the passing, fleeting moments of time. For one moment you're weeping, the next you're laughing, one moment you scatter, the next you gather. And so life goes on. One moment leads to another moment, moment after moment, month after month, year after year, decade after decade. And so we're here to remember, but sometimes it's painful to remember. To remember the past and all those who died. I remember Remembrance Sundays when I was a young boy in the 1970s. Back then, memories were still raw, and the streets would be full of men and women who were actually crying. That doesn't happen so much now. I'm not blaming anybody for that, because time passes and memories fade. But we're still left with a question. And the question is this: how will we remember all those who have died? How will we remember all those who have suffered and given up their lives in war after war after war? And then can we say that we've actually made any progress? Do you think? It's an important question. Especially for victors, especially for those who've won, because we did win. We fought in the battlefields of Normandy and we won. We fought in the deserts of North Africa and we won. We won in the skies over London. We won our battles at sea. And this raises a question. It's wonderful, but what for? To what end? Would you say that we as a nation have become kinder? Do you think we've become more gentle? Would you say we've become more forgiving of each other? I was listening to Rabbi Jonathan Sacks the other day. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks was the chief rabbi until 2013, and he is a very, very worried man, I'll tell you that. He's very worried indeed. And on the 21st of September this year, he was speaking at the Hampstead Synagogue in London, and he asked the question, why have we as a nation become so unforgiving? Is this why we fought? And he relates a tragic tale of a man who, in a throwaway line in a lecture, said something really, really stupid. Really stupid. For which he immediately apologized. Now, this man was a professor. He was a recipient of the Nobel Prize. He was a world-leading intellectual and scientist. And yet, before the day was out, he had been stripped of his professorship, barred from his university, and was publicly shamed and ridiculed. He was broken by the mob. And he had no recourse to any appeal, and so a lifetime of dedicated, outstanding scientific endeavor that had helped many was taken away just like that for a few stupid words. And I thought, having listened to the rabbi, I thought, is this why we won? So that we might fool ourselves, that we have become more open and tolerant and diverse, and yet at the same time have become harder. and more self-righteous and more intransigent and more hostile towards those who say things with which we disagree. And so we are a nation which seems to be in the process of turning away from each other and are becoming more divided and more entrenched. And if you said this to the writer of Ecclesiastes, he would say, look, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that nothing ever seems to change. And that in this world, moment follows moment, and week follows week, and year follows year, and no real progress ever seems to be made. He says, I'm not surprised, because if we're ever going to make progress, so that we become more gentle, more kind, more forgiving, we need to answer the question, who is responsible? Who is responsible for the battles and the wars and the fighting and the killing? Who is responsible for injustice and death? Who is responsible for the death of Haran Baronian? And what we're now saying is, those people over there are. Those people. Those people who, like that professor, say hateful things and so reveal what's in their hearts, they're to blame. It's those others who are not like me, who are different from me, who don't think like I do, and so what we get is the poor blame the rich blame the poor. Women blame men, men blame women, Remainers blame Brexiteers, Brexiteers blame Remainers. We blame gender, we blame the Jews, the immigrants, the posh, the bigots, the deplorables. Everybody not like us, of course. We never blame ourselves. It's those people over there. Because we have to blame someone, don't we? And so we've all become outraged. Outraged at everyone and everybody else. Not outraged at ourselves, of course. Oh, no. We give ourselves a pass. It's others. And that is, you know, that's why I dread this upcoming election, don't you? Because it seems to be that we're just going to see more of this type of thing. And so the rabbi is right. In a world of outrage, there is no forgiveness. And so we all retreat to our tribes, blaming the other. And this reminds me of a play I read some years ago. It was so long ago, I can't remember the name. I think the name of the play was God in the Dock. And this play is set in a small town outside a concentration camp. And as the Allies sweep in, they round up the townsfolk and they say, who is responsible for this? Who is responsible for these crimes against humanity? And the townsfolk say, it's not us. It's those above us. And so they round up the town council and the mayor. And they say, who is responsible? And the town council say, well, it's not us. It's our masters above us. And so they round them up and they say to them, who is responsible? They cry, it's not us. It's the people above us. And so they end up in Berlin and they round up the prime minister and the cabinet and they say, who is responsible? And they all cry out, it's not us. And the one person says, it's God. He's responsible. He created this miserable world in which we live and die. God is responsible. Which, incidentally, is how the Bible opens. The Bible opens with men and women turning on each other. Adam turns on Eve, Eve turns on the serpent, and Adam, Eve, and the serpent turn against God. And they all shake their little fists and they say, you're to blame. They shake their fists at heaven. I wonder if you noticed what the writer of Ecclesiastes said. In our reading, he said, there is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heaven. Under the heavens. In other words, in this world in which moment follows moment and day follows day. And you see what he's driving at? He's saying, if you want to find forgiveness, in order to find rest for your souls, in order to find an inner peace that can heal the outrage and the blame shifting, what you need to do is to look above the heavens. You need to look at the one who's seated at the right hand of God the Father Almighty. You need to look at him, because there came a moment, when Caesar Augustus was the emperor in Rome and Quirinius was the governor of Syria, that Jesus Christ, the eternal Son of God, came down to earth from heaven. He who was God and Lord of all came down. He who was seated in the heavens came down to earth. And you know what Jesus did? He took the blame. Although he was innocent, humankind said to him, "You're the one. You're to blame. You are responsible." And so he died. On the cross of crucifixion, he died slowly and by inches and in public, being mocked. And God in heaven poured down on his head the wrath that was coming to you and to me. Because of our inability to forgive, for our refusing to take responsibility for what we have done to the world and done to each other. And so Jesus died, the sinless Son of God. Now, can you just sense the power of this? Can you see that if you take this into your heart, if you root this into your life, it's going to give you rest? It's going to give you peace. For once you know that God has forgiven you, you've got huge resources there to forgive others. Because if you offended God and he's forgiven you, how can you possibly not forgive others when they offend you? Which they will. Other people will offend you. Because now you won't be saying it's them over there. You'll be saying it's me. I am the one. I am responsible. For I turned my back on God. I lived my life as if he did not exist. But now I'm forgiven. And if I'm forgiven, can't you then forgive others? And do you know what happens when you do that? We've already sung about it. You'll begin to hear the angels and archangels of heaven singing. You'll begin to know that forgiveness is possible. And then your hearts will be brave again and your arms will be strong, because you'll hear Jesus Christ on the cross say, "Father, forgive them, because they don't know what they do." And you'll heard him say to you, in the depths of your heart, "Come to me, all ye who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Amen.